I work alone. I'm not part of a local police force. I am the local police force. Well, hey, folks, how are you? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sunsound, Arizona. Very grateful you tuned in. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Alice Hatcher bring us our first story, and it's called Into the Weeds. The hardest thing about being a small-town cop in northern Vermont is that most days you don't do much, and on the days you do, no one wants to know what you did. On a typical day, I'm issuing speeding tickets to tourists flying down back roads in BMWs and Audis. We call them moose bait, on their way to lake houses and ski resorts. Other days, I'm responding to domestic violence calls, administering Narcan to overdoses, arresting drunk drivers, or securing the scenes of car crashes, hunting accidents, and suicides. I mop up after local tragedies, and there's no one to talk about it with. No one wants to hear gruesome details about victims they knew, or ugly stories about people they'll run into at the grocery store. It's too much horror, too close to home. If I'm dealing with a body, I'll call the state police. Otherwise, I work alone. I'm not part of a local police force. I am the local police force. And I probably spend too much time in my head. There's a certain kind of, well, loneliness that comes from living in a place where you know everyone, but where most people associate you with the worst day of their lives. I feel it most when I'm having breakfast at the Four Jacks. Most people are polite to me. Some are grateful for the time I give them a ride home after their car broke down, or gave them a warning instead of a speeding ticket. But even those who nod or smile keep their distance. Most people clam up around cops, and in a small town, people don't want to get tangled up in ugly situations involving their neighbors. I still go to Fort Jack's for breakfast, though. Janine worked there for years, and even after we broke up last time, she always found a few minutes between orders to talk to me on a, well, kind of like a normal person. The morning Mrs. Stockard marched into the Four Jacks looking for me, Janine had called in sick, and the other waitresses were scrambling to cover for her. Everything was taking longer than usual, and I had been sitting by myself at the counter for 20 minutes, studying French words on the bilingual menu for truckers from Quebec, scrolling on my phone for news about the heat wave hitting the Northeast, and fantasizing about applying for a job on a larger police force in a different town. The fact is, though, I'm too old to make a serious career move and too young to retire. In a different line of work, I might coast to retirement, but quiet quitting isn't an option when you're a cop. When a call comes, you have to answer. You have to deal with whatever tragedy is on tap, with every kind of personality, with people like Mrs. Stockard. I was rubbing an arthritic finger when she angled up to the counter. "I thought I'd find you here. Having a late breakfast," she said, as Mary Watkins set an omelet and a side of home fries in front of me. I turned sideways on my stool to find Mrs. Stockard scrutinizing me with her piercing blue eyes. She hadn't addressed me as Mark or Mr. Russo or Officer Russo, and I had to remind myself she never bothered with niceties or formalities. I wasn't special in Mrs. Stockard's world. Well, nobody was. Given my mood, I found that almost refreshing. Mary filled my coffee cup and placed a check next to my plate. "I'll leave this here, Mark," She gave a sideways glance at Mrs. Stockard and moved down the counter, filling mugs and making small talk with people who had been keeping their backs to me all morning. "How are ya, Mrs. Stockard?" I placed my arm on the counter to brace myself. People who don't know any better, tourists, would probably call Mrs. Stockard spry or feisty. I would call her mean.
"I'm perfectly fine, but I'm not here to talk about myself," she stated. "I'm here to report a man who walked into my truck as I was driving down Mill Road this morning."
Now slow down, Mrs. Stockard," I said, raising my palm. She recoiled from my hand.
Am I talking too fast for you?"
"It's simple.
I saw a man, heard a thud, and then didn't see anyone."
"Did you look in your rearview mirror?" I had to ask. People talking to cops often equivocate. I probably shouldn't have bothered asking Mrs. Stockard for clarification. She never equivocated.
"Well, of course I checked my mirror. That was implied when I said I didn't see anyone."
"But you saw a man, you said?" She pushed up the sleeves of her denim shirt.
"I said I saw a man because I saw a man walking along the road. I heard a thud as I was passing him, and when I checked my rearview mirror, he was gone."
I couldn't help wondering if her 85 years had finally caught up to her, and her eyesight or mind had degenerated to a point of unreliability. She seemed more annoyed than anything, recounting an incident that would have driven most people to tears or panic.
"Is it possible you hit an animal, Mrs. Stockard? A deer?"
"You're not listening. I said I hit a man. I saw him very clearly."
"Did you stop to see if he was okay?"
"Of course I didn't. I'm not going to stop all by myself to look for some half-crazed druggie hanging around at the edge of the woods."
"What makes you think he was using drugs, Mrs. Stockard?"
"Well, who the hell else would be walking along Mill Road looking like he did at 7 a.m.? He was filthy, probably out of his mind."
She had a point. No one ever walked along Mill Road. It didn't connect anywhere to anything, and there were only 3 houses, including Janine's, on its 5-mile stretch. It was all the more reason to think she had hit a deer.
"Well, let's go outside and take a look at your truck."
I stood up, tossed a 20 on the counter, and waved to Mary. "Could you box this up and toss it under the warmer? I'll be back in about an hour."
"Sorry your order took so long. We're pretty stretched without Janine. I'll catch you later."
She glanced at Mrs. Stockard.
"When things aren't so busy." "Well, these days people stub their toes and call in sick," Mrs. Stockard said,
weaving between tables on her way to the exit.
"When I put my husband in the ground, I was barely 30 years old and had a dairy farm to run. I hadn't taken a day off since. You won't find me sitting at home watching TV, moaning about this or that or the other, ever."
"You've led a very healthy life, Mrs. Stockard," I said, directing conversation away from Janine.
If Mrs. Stockard's comments had no foundation, there was no point in correcting them. She had made up her mind about stub toes and slacking.
"It's really impressive."
"It shouldn't be impressive. It's what you do. It's what I do. I've had to fire grown men because they couldn't lift a 50-pound bag of feed. Now,"
she paused at the exit and waited for me to open the door.
"People talk about how they can't find good help these days. I've never been able to find good help. At least the truck's been reliable."
She was right about the truck. She drove a faded blue 1993 Ford 250, a beat-up farm truck, though she probably shouldn't have been driving at all. It was so dinged up from years of use that it would have been difficult to isolate evidence of a recent collision if it wasn't for the mirror mounted on the passenger door. The glass, badly cracked and barely clinging to its backing with a misaligned frame. The mount's lower bracket had separated from the door, and paint had been stripped from the edges of the screw hole. The damaged mirror was mounted at the height of a person's head or shoulder, and it was possible that she had clipped a man standing on the roadside. On the other hand, it wasn't unusual for deer to buck right before impact. "Now, exactly where did this incident happen, Mrs. Stockett?" I asked, examining the twisted metal of the detached bracket. "Halfway town, Mill Road, heading north." "Did you happen to note the time of the incident that had occurred?" "Just after 7, and I hope the guy's still there. He owes me money for my mirror."
"And you just got here?"
"It's 8:30, Mrs. Stockard."
"I can read a watch. I picked up some supplies at the feed store on the way, and Gerard Shaw wouldn't open his door until 8. He heard me knocking. He must think he doesn't need my business."
I rested my hand on my belt. "Mrs. Stockard, if you hit a man, you left the scene of an accident. That's against the law," I explained, taking care to avoid the phrase hit and run. There was no reason to escalate tensions, and odds were she had hit a deer.
"There's no if, and I didn't commit a crime. I was driving the speed limit, staying in my lane, and that man was walking half in the road."
"Well, now, that doesn't matter. You should have stayed in your truck and called 911.
"Well, with what? I don't have a phone."
I rubbed my forehead. "At your age, you really should carry a phone."
"So every kind of jackass and scam artist can call me."
"Yeah, I hear you, Mrs. Stockett. I hear you." I'd been with her for less than 5 minutes, and I was already employing standard police techniques for diffusing charged situations, offering the kind of neutral, noncommittal statements that often give distressed people a sense of being heard. The thing is, Mrs. Stockard wasn't distressed. I shielded my eyes against the sun. "If we drove out to Mill Road to take a look around, would you be able to pinpoint where it happened, Mrs. Stockard?"
"Well, of course I can. I'm not blind."
I considered the worn treads on the truck's tires, the rust edging her dented hubcaps, and the cracked plastic cover of one of her headlights.
"We'll take my cruiser. You can ride in the front."
It was going to be another sweltering August day, and my shirt was already damp with sweat by the time we reached the turnoff onto Mill Road. Mrs. Stockard seemed more than comfortable in her denim shirt and heavy boots. She seemed certain, too, that she had hit a man, and despite that, completely at ease in the cruiser, to the point of telling me how to do my job.
"You ought to have that thing towed," she insisted, as we neared a black Dodge Charger parked on a gravel pull-off. "People shouldn't be leaving their cars wherever they please."
"Well, now, it is legal to temporarily park in a pull-out," I said, slowing to note the car's Massachusetts plates and bright green puddle of antifreeze just behind the front left tire. "Now, especially if the car breaks down."
"But that thing's practically sticking out onto the road. If they have a real reason to abandon that heap, they should put on their hazards. My guess is someone started drinking last night and never stopped. If we got out, I bet we'd find him hiding a kite, stark naked, relieving himself in a creek, or worse, or maybe sleeping it off."
Mrs. Stockard shook her head.
"These tourists think they can do whatever they want, whenever they want. If there isn't a shopping mall on it, they think it's public property. You should radio for a tow truck."
"I think we should deal with the matter at hand, Mrs. Stockard."
"It is the matter at hand. That car is a hazard. At some point, the driver will wander right into the road just like the last guy, she said, after we passed the car. That's what these hoodlums from Providence and these mass holes from Boston do. Get high on pills and pot and leave their garbage for other people to clean up. Beer cans, bottles. I found a condom once.
You might be jumping the gun.
I'm not blind or crazy. I know what these people are like.
She folded her arms across her chest. These degenerates from Massachusetts are almost always as bad as the New Yorkers running away from the mess they created in Manhattan, taking a vacation from their penthouses and trying their hand at country living. I could tell them all about country living. I'd start by telling them the day doesn't start with a pancake brunch. Cows need to eat. They need water.
They sure do, I said, keeping my voice steady. It's always something.
For the next few minutes, I tried to ignore Mrs. Stockard's running commentary about perverts, pancakes, and drug addicts eating brunch and thought about my home fries drying out in a styrofoam box. My stomach was empty and unsettled. I was hoping Mrs. Stockard had hit the deer hard enough to kill it. I was in no mood to put down an injured animal.
The cows need to be milked, Mrs. Stockard continued, at dawn.
Well, I hear you, Mrs. Stockard. Just let me know when we're close.
It's 2 miles up the road, just past the twisted guardrail that idiot from Connecticut hit when he swerved to Miss Glenn Nelson's dog last year. That's exactly where the man walked into my truck this morning.
I considered the blurred shapes of trees whipping past and wondered if Mrs. Stockard's eyesight was better than I imagined, her memory unexpectedly reliable, or her imagination wildly overblown. I wondered if she thought the idiot from Connecticut had been wrong to spare Glenn Nelson's dog. Just past the twisted guardrail, 50 feet past a gap in the bank of tall weeds edging the road, Mrs. Stockard told me to pull over. I twisted sideways in my seat and looked back at the disturbed weeds and undergrowth.
Are you sure it was here, or did we go too far?
It was right here, Mrs. Stockard insisted. I saw a white guy in filthy clothes doing Lord knows what, probably didn't have a thought in his head.
It's going to take some time to search the area, and I want to be as sure as I can that I've been driving these roads for 70 years, half of them before they were even paved. I know where I was, and he stepped in front of my truck right here.
I was hoping she would stay in the car, but she got out of the cruiser to watch me set up orange triangular safety signs and examine the asphalt for skid marks or streaks of blood. 50 feet behind the cruiser, I crouched beside a swath of trampled ferns and flattened grass, hoping I might find some hoof prints. But it hadn't rained in weeks.
"I'm going to take a look around. You stay near the car," I said, overcome by the heat and the fact that I was about to wade into the woods and probably pick up a few ticks, searching for a half-dead deer lying on the ground bleeding out.
Thinking more about home fries than hit and runs, I forged into the weeds and followed a crude path into the woods, noting blood on the tips of one or two ferns and wondering how far a badly injured deer might have dragged its broken body. 15 feet from the road, the ground angled sharply downward, and I skidded sideways, cursing each time I slid into brambles or nettles, until I was standing on level ground at the base of the ravine. The air was humid and close near the creek, and even in the deep shade I was sweating profusely. I looked up at a narrow patch of sky visible above the creek, slapped a mosquito on my neck, and scanned the stony bank. Just as I was about to turn around and head back to the road, I noticed, in the bush and humus beside a decaying log the delicate straps of a platform sandal. The sight of a badly scratched foot, an ankle discolored by bruises, and bloody shreds of denim thread across a pale calf. For a moment everything froze, as my mind struggled to adjust to the reality that Mrs. Stockard hadn't hit a deer. From the color of the skin and the blood pooled at the back of the leg, I knew I was looking at a lifeless body, and I felt a familiar dread. By evening, I would be breaking devastating news to a family I knew and arresting Mrs. Stockard for manslaughter. I swallowed the bile rising in my throat, took a few deep breaths, and approached the body. I felt both relieved and confused as I crouched down to consider the form nestled in the bed of old leaves beneath the log's underside. I didn't recognize the upturned face, and I was clearly looking at a woman's body. I pressed my fingertips to the neck in a futile search for pulse and found the skin cold and stiff to the touch. I considered the close-cropped hair matted to the scalp behind the ear and the sharp, unnatural bend of the twisted ankle. In her panic, the woman had probably dug her heel into the pavement in the instant before the mirror hit her head, gotten thrown into the weeds, and in her delirium, wandered to the bottom of the ravine and fallen unconscious. Mrs. Stockard had likely registered a man's haircut and made a snap decision about her victim's identity. I imagined Mrs. Stockard standing behind my car. As awful as she was, I dreaded the prospect of arresting an 85-year-old who might be losing her eyesight or mental facilities. I berated myself for not having her license revoked years ago, but then I told myself Mrs. Stockard had never shown any signs of cognitive impairment, even if she was entirely deficient in civility. I had issued her warnings for speeding a few times, but she had never broken any laws that any young person doesn't break all the time. The issue was moot anyway. My only responsibilities then were to call the state police and a forensics team from Montpellier, preserve the crime scene, and fill out a report that would likely be used against Mrs. Stockard in court. When Mrs. Stockard and I were both back at the cruiser, I told her I had discovered the body of a woman and tried to explain the gravity of the situation without using the terms manslaughter and felony. Until I charged her with a crime, there was no need to agitate her, especially since we were going to be waiting together on the roadside for at least an hour. Mrs. Stockard, you need to be aware that it's against the law in this state to leave the scene of a traffic accident without stopping. When she arrives, a state police officer is going to have a few questions. You can answer them or not, but you need to know that we're talking about a hit-and-run, a crime. And you should be aware that I didn't hit a woman. I have no idea what she's doing here, but I had nothing to do with it, so I didn't break any law. I nodded slowly. Mrs. Stockard, I'll need to see your driver's license. While she fished her wallet from her purse, I studied her face for signs of distress. If anything, she was agitated because she thought I was wasting her time and tax dollars with pointless questions. She nearly bit my head off when I asked her if she had been wearing glasses at the time of the accident. The same glasses you always see me wearing. And what's the prescription on those, Mrs. Stockard? The hell if I know. It's the same prescription I've had for years. Are you saying you haven't had your eyes tested in the last 2 years? Mrs. Stockard looked at me like I was one of the degenerates she imagined having brunch on Tuesdays. I know what I need, and what I don't need is to be handing hundreds of dollars over to some fancy doctor for a pair of glasses every 6 months. She pulled a Swiss Army knife from her shirt and started soothing the edge of a fingernail with a metal file.
Are you going to keep that air conditioning going the whole time we're sitting here?
Are you cold, Mrs. Stockard?
My tax dollars pay your salary, and they pay for that air conditioning.
She started scraping at a callus on her thumb.
It wasn't long ago that people in Vermont didn't have air conditioning in their cars. It was an option you turned down at the dealer to save money.
Mrs. Stockard, it's supposed to hit 97 degrees today.
It's not 97 yet, and running the car for AC is a waste of money. My money.
When she started talking about working every day, no matter what the weather, I turned off the AC and rolled down the windows. Things were about to get very bad for her, and I saw no reason to make the situation, hers or mine, any worse. When I finished filling out my report, I got out of the car and, with the feeling of Mrs. Stockard's eyes boring into my back, counted the seconds until the state police and the forensics team arrived from Montpelier. Officer Jen Chapman and the forensics team arrived about 10:30. Jen's exchange with Mrs. Stockard was short, and I didn't hear any of it, even though she had asked Mrs. Stockard to step out of the cruiser. At the time, I was guiding the forensics team down the crude path leading to the creek and watching a photographer document the victim's injuries. When I returned to the road, Jen was leaning against the side of her SUV, dragging her palm across the back of her neck. Mrs. Stockard was in my cruiser, still filing her nails.
"Well, she's a treat," Jen said.
"Aye, op."
"She has no idea what she's facing."
"Nope."
"We'll need to impound her truck."
I know."
"Ain't gonna be easy."
No, it won't."
I let out a long exhale. There was nothing more to say until the head of the forensics team climbed out of the ravine 20 minutes later. He looked genuinely confused.
"Well, now, the medical examiner will have to confirm everything," he said, "but I don't see any evidence of blunt force trauma around the neck, head, or shoulder. What you got in the back of the head is a gunshot wound."
Jen pushed away from the SUV.
"What the heck are you talking about?"
"Well, I've been doing this long enough to recognize a gunshot wound."
No, I wasn't questioning you, Steve. It's just... we got an old lady telling me she clipped a pervert getting high in the woods. A man."
"I'm seeing contusions and bruising, lacerations, a possible ankle fracture," Steve said. "I can't be sure about the gunshot wound, but the bruising around the ankle could be 12 hours old.
"Well, looks like you got a murder case," Jen said, turning to me. "Does Mrs. Stockard own a firearm?"
"No, just a set of car keys."
I rubbed a fresh mosquito bite on my cheek.
"She's a menace, but she's not a murderer."
"But why did she lead you right to this place?"
"Well, she keeps saying the same thing over and over, that, yeah, I know that she hit a man. Hanged if I know what she's talking about.
Looks like we've got a standard body dump. The suspect could be hours away from here by now. They could even be in Canada. Why don't you start the canvas right now? See if anyone around here heard or saw anything."
"Well, there are only 3 houses along this road," I said. "Closest one's about a mile from here. I know the owner, Janine Frazier. I'll talk to locals with records of violent crimes, too."
"What are you going to do with our friend, Mrs. Stockard?" Jen asked.
"Well, I'll take her back to her truck after I finish the canvas."
"What about the mirror?"
"What about it?"
"How was it damaged?"
"I couldn't tell you. Maybe she clipped someone's truck outside the feed store."
"Maybe the truck of some druggie from Massachusetts buying chicken feed," Jen said, wiping sweat from the corner of her eye.
At the mention of Massachusetts, I looked over at Mrs. Stockard.
"You know, there was a car on the pull-off about 2 miles back, Dodge Charger with Massachusetts plates, radiator fluid beneath it, no one in the car.
I wonder if the victim broke down last night and started walking, got offered a ride by, maybe the wrong guy.
Well, I'll drive out to the car and run its place while you start the canvas. Leave our friend in the car when you start asking questions. I'm guessing most people shut down around her.
Yep. They sure do, I said.
When I got back into the cruiser, Mrs. Stockard was poking the skin around an ingrown fingernail with the tip of her knife. She didn't look up when she explained again that she hadn't hit a deer or a woman, but rather a filthy young man who was asking to get hit by walking half in the road at the crack of dawn.
"If people gave a hoot about hard work, we wouldn't be seeing these types," she said. "When you have 80 dairy cows to feed, you don't have time for drugs or lying around in the woods. In my day, it was hippies on LSD heading for Canada, lawbreakers, people out of their minds. Now it's all these dopas from down south bringing their crime, their drugs, and breaking into houses."
Maybe it was Mrs. Stockard's talk, but I had a bad feeling when I pulled in Janine's rutted driveway and saw her house. A small white cape tucked back into the woods, and her rusted Honda Civic parked beside it. Her cat, a black and white tuxedo named Tuxie, was crouched on her porch looking up at the front door. I reminded myself that I had always asked Janine to toss Tuxie outside when I stayed over because he had a way of crawling all over us at the worst moments, well, or the best moments, and taking up most of the bed when we were trying to sleep. Honestly, I felt more relieved than jealous. Even if Janine had called in sick to spend mornings in bed with someone new, I told myself she was safe at home. Still, I was tense, anticipating an awkward situation, and Mrs. Stockard was making everything worse.
"Well, now she ought to cut those branches back and widen this driveway," she muttered. "Wouldn't take 5 minutes. Should be able to do it herself, but she's probably waiting for some man to take care of it."
I gripped the steering wheel, imagining some guy's car parked in the small clearing behind the house, where I had always parked when I spent the night at Janine's. As I neared the house, Tuxie leapt down from the porch. I braked and watched him slink around the side of the house with his ears folded down and his tail hanging low.
"Well, now, while she's sleeping it off with the curtains down, she could be fixing this place up." Mrs. Stockard rapped her knuckles on the passenger window as a branch scraped the glass. "She has shade all around, and she's closed up every window, probably running the air conditioning like money grows on trees and watching TV in the middle of the day."
Despite the distraction of Mrs. Stockard's speculations, or maybe because of it, I suddenly saw the situation before me with a sickening clarity. Janine didn't have air conditioning. Janine's house was set back from the road and surrounded by trees, so Janine always kept her blinds open, at least in the summer, when the leaves provided cover. Janine had never called in sick to spend a late morning with me. She couldn't afford to take days off. Mrs. Stockard had a dismal personality, but passable vision. She was positive she had hit a man. If she had, he was still at large. I should have gotten Mrs. Stockard away from the house and called for backup right away, but with Janine inside, hopefully still alive, hesitation wasn't an option. What's more, I didn't want to force a standoff or hostage situation by having the state police surround the house. If someone had forced their way into Janine's house, I had to give the appearance of making a routine call, even if it meant proceeding without backup, and with a civilian in tow. I admit, I was making the best bad decision I could, based on a strange feeling Mrs. Stockard's venomous observation and the body language of a chronically irritable cat.
"Wait here, Mrs. Stockard. I need to ask Janine Frazier a few questions.
I'm leaving the keys in the ignition in case you need to leave in a hurry."
Mrs. Stockard didn't register the sudden shift in my mood.
"Ask her what she's doing in bed at 10 a.m.
"Don't get out of the car," I said. "Don't do a single thing." Mrs. Stockard was examining the tip of her thumb when I climbed out of the cruiser. With as much composure as I could muster, I approached Janine's house without drawing my gun and stepped onto the front porch. Seeing no signs of forced entry, footprints on the door, or damage to the lock mechanism, I knocked, waited, and rang the doorbell. I looked for signs of movement in the windows, then walked around the back of the house and drew my gun. Shades were drawn behind every window. Aside from the cruiser, Janine's car was the only vehicle on the property, but Tuxie was crouched next to Janine's woodpile, hissing. His eyes were dilated and dark, his ears were pressed flat against his head, and his fur was standing in a sharp ridge along his spine. Thinking only about Janine's safety, I decided to act on a hunch and enter the house without a warrant or warning. Janine, fortunately, had ignored my advice to find a better hiding place for her spare key. With my gun ready, I stepped up to the back door, slipped a key from beneath the flower pot on the stoop, and in one fluid motion turned the key in the lock and kicked my way into Janine's kitchen. Inside, I found drawers off their runners, cabinets hanging wide open, and the biting chemical smell of meth in the air. I glanced at the living room and, fearing the worst, made the split-second decision to enter the hallway leading to the bedroom. Edging around the corners and expecting gunfire at every turn, passing the bathroom, I noticed the rifled medicine cabinet and streaks of blood on Janine's sink. I was almost at the bedroom when I heard someone screaming in the front yard. I froze for an instant and then ran to the living room. The front door was standing open. Just beyond the porch, a scrawny man dressed in only filthy jeans was lurching toward the cruiser with his right arm draped around Janine's neck and a handgun pointed up at Janine's jaw. The entire left side of his body was twisted. His shoulder was sagging, and his arm was hanging at his side like a dead weight, pulling him toward the ground. He was gasping like someone with several broken ribs, but he was closing in on the cruiser, staggering and screaming at Mrs. Stockard to get out of the car. When she didn't move, he lurched toward the passenger window, dragging Janine behind him. He leaned into the glass.
"Get out, or I'll kill her!"
he screamed, struggling to keep his handgun angled toward Janine's face.
"I'll do it right now if you don't open up!"
Janine raised her hands and twisted in the man's grip. I was watching her, waiting for a clean shot, when Mrs. Stockard spun sideways in the passenger seat and slammed the cruiser door open with her feet, winging the murderer for the second time in 6 hours. When the door hit his ribs, the man released an inhumane shriek and collapsed. A shot rang out and Janine bolted into the woods while the front tire of my cruiser deflated with a sharp hiss. When I reached the cruiser, the man was writhing on the ground in agony and Mrs. Stockard was sitting in the passenger seat, shaking her head in disgust. Once again, I had mopped up an ugly scene. This time, though, no one in town knew the suspect or victim, so everyone wanted to know everything. As usual, no one wanted to talk to me. There's not much to say to a guy who let an 85-year-old woman do his job. As I overheard Gerard Shaw say at the Four Jacks, "It doesn't matter that I was right about Janine's closed windows and the broken-down car. The Dodge Charger belonged to a small-time drug dealer from Springfield, Massachusetts. He had murdered an undercover cop in a shootout and was heading for Canada with his girlfriend when his car, leaking radiator fluid from a bullet hole, overheated. He had abandoned the Charger and started off on foot with plans to steal or hijack a car at the first house he found. After his girlfriend twisted her ankle, walking along the road at night in platform sandals, he killed her because
she was slowing him down,
only to get clipped by Mrs. Stockard after dumping the body. He'd broken into Janine's place looking for provisions and a car, only to get boxed in by my cruiser and subdued by an 85-year-old woman armed with nothing more than a Swiss Army knife, a car door, and a withering stare. Nothing will change the fact that Mrs. Stockard did the takedown. That's what people will remember. They'll tell stories about how she saved Janine Fraser's life while I looked on from the front porch. A local hero, Mrs. Stockard, will be eating free pancakes at the Four Jacks for the rest of her life. After the local paper ran a full-page story on Mrs. Stockard, the Ford dealership in St. Johnsbury replaced her mirror, gave her truck a tune-up, and fitted it with four new all-weather tires. I got a box of cold home fries and a letter of reprimand for violating protocol in pursuit of a dangerous suspect, for making the best bad decision I could in a crisis. But I'm going into the weeds. The main thing is that Janine and I are back together, happily and maybe forever this time, even if Tuxie still hisses when I toss him outside. Janine overhears the same things I overhear, and she's listened to me ruminate about Mrs. Stockard dozens of times. But she knows the whole story, and she feels a certain kind of love that comes from knowing that I was the only good thing about the worst day of her life. All right, now to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine and their Department of the First Stories. A story by Rick Marcoux, and it's called Baggage. Jillian picked up the black Toomey bag, a look of sheer satisfaction on her face.
This is the one. It's perfect. I love it.
Seriously? It's black. We talked about this. Everyone travels with a black bag. It's impossible to find on the baggage claim belt. Someone else could grab it by thinking it's theirs. I tell you this all the time. Get a different color. You'll be much happier. Justin was getting frustrated. He'd been down this road with her before. Probably why they never bought one and were here now a week before their big trip. He agreed to shop at Toomey, which was expensive but good quality. But he didn't want to give in on the color. He stood there, both hands in the front pockets of his jeans, his domestic battle stance.
This one makes me happy. Why don't you understand that? Black bags are so much classier than those other ones. Who wants a teal bag or pink or whatever color people get?
Jillian was getting more and more like this lately, wanting classier things. She had a real job now, earning a decent paycheck, thought that it was time for classy things. Like her friends, all of whom made more money, but, in her opinion, didn't deserve to.
I do. Well, maybe not teal or pink. Why not that blue one or that cool gray color one over there? It's the same bag.
Not the same. And this is for me. Why do you even care?
Because when you're waiting at baggage claim and you don't know your bag, just know it's because someone else grabbed it.
Marta led Thiago up the stairs, her flashlight leading the way, but her familiarity making it easy even in the dark. She'd been cleaning this house for only a couple of months, been here maybe four times in total, but it was enough for her to do it blindfolded if she needed to. They reached the bedroom. Thiago impatiently asked, "Where is it?"
"In the closet there.
and she led him straight back to the closet where the safe was hidden. It was shielded by the wife's hanging clothes behind a panel built into the wall. 2 weeks ago, she was cleaning and had already finished the upstairs but came back up to grab the soft scrub she had left in the hall bathroom. As she passed the bedroom door, she peered in and saw the husband on his knees in the closet with what appeared to be an open safe. She could see stacks of bills and some shiny things she figured were jewelry. She didn't know what the husband did for a living, but from the house and the cars, she knew they had money. He didn't strike her as a typical businessman like some of her past clients taking a briefcase to work and wearing boring old man suits. He wore lots of dark clothing and came and went randomly during the day. And one time, she saw him carrying a gun in his waistband, so who knows how he made that kind of money. He just seemed shady and dangerous. The closet now appeared a little emptier than usual. Some bare hangers. The wife must have packed heavily for their weekend trip. Marta moved the remaining clothing to the side, grabbed off the panel, and let Thiago do the rest. He was in his comfort zone, staring at a safe he knew well. He opened up his tool case and went to work, and within about 7 minutes was inside. "Dios mio," he said when he saw what was in there. There were 4 stacks of cash, each about a foot high, and each had $100 bill on top. He didn't have time to try to figure out how much it was there, but it seemed like what $1 million might look like. Behind the cash was a tray with jewelry on it, including a diamond necklace and several pair of earrings. Marta was momentarily frozen when she looked at the treasure. "Whoa, that's a lot more than I saw last time. Wasn't even half that."
"That's good, right? We take it all?"
"Sí, posiblemente. But I don't know. I was thinking before, maybe we take a little, and maybe they don't notice, and, you know, maybe we stay here. But with all this, oh, whoa, we could be rich for the rest of our lives with this kind of money."
She stared at the piles, eyes still wide, but her mind racing.
No, we gotta leave, like, leave the country."
"You sure? We could just move somewhere, like to the East Coast."
"No, I think this guy could find us. I don't know. I just get the feeling like he's got connections or something. Maybe just in the U.S. I don't know. Not in Costa Rica, though. They don't even know where I'm from. I never give my real name, just my nickname."
"Está bien. If you want, we can go home.
Sí, but let's get out of here. Throw it all in the bag."
She hesitated a moment.
Wait, leave the jewelry. She's a nice lady. I don't want to take that from her."
"What are you doing?" Julian asked, seemingly annoyed.
"I'm filling out your contact info on the baggage tag."
"I can do that. Why are you bothering?"
"Well, because your handwriting sucks, and we both know that. I'm just trying to be helpful."
"Yeah, but helpful insulting me."
"Sorry, I apologize. That was rude of me. I just wanted to do something to help while you finish packing. Plus, I'm really happy about this tag, and that you agreed to it."
He was flipping the red tag up into the air and catching it.
"That was a good idea. I agree. Glad the guy at the store suggested it."
I think he saw he might not get a sale otherwise.
"Yes, he would have." Jillian walked away, smiling after turning her back on him.
"Are you almost done packing? I want to go grab dinner."
"Almost. Let me check the weather app again. It's going to be sunny and warm most days, right?"
"Yeah, but remember, we're going to the rainforest at least once. That's in the mountains. It'll be cold and wet. Costa Rica is kind of unpredictable."
When Thiago walked into the apartment, Marta came rushing into the front room from the bedroom.
"You got it, excelente, let me see."
Tiago took the suitcase out of the bag, beaming with his purchase.
"What is Tumi?" she asked.
"The brand name. Best quality bag out there."
"Expensive?"
"Si, but worth it. We need to make sure the bag is strong and has good locks and stuff."
"Well, that's good. I agree."
"I got black. I didn't want to stand out, you know. But the guy at the counter said to get a different color tag, easier to see on the baggage thing at the airport. I got red. For Costa Rica."
"Ooh, I like that."
"Me too. Let's go pack it up. Make sure everything fits. Anything we can't fit in, we'll throw out. And just get new stuff there. We can afford it," he added. "We can start to live like rich people now."
"Not yet,"
Marta shook her head. "Not until we're safe at home." Nicholas looked over at Mateo, who was diligently picking at his fingernails like he was putting the finishing touches on a painting. Nicholas wondered what was going through Mateo's mind. He always wondered what was going through Mateo's mind. He remembered when they were kids playing with their football team, and what Mateo did to one of his teammates. It was never proven, but Nicholas knew it was Mateo who did it. Mateo didn't like the teammate, Jorge, who happened to be the starting striker ahead of him, because he was a far better player. So Mateo sat on the bench. One game, Jorge was caught with an opponent's leather jacket in his soccer bag. None of these kids had any money. This was a poor neighborhood. But the visiting team was from a nicer area, so closer to San Jose. Jorge was kicked off the team for stealing, despite screaming that he didn't do it. Mateo had a sly look on his face the whole time, though maybe only Nicholas noticed it. But he'd also noticed that at one point in the second half, Mateo had run back to the bathrooms, and the visiting team's van was parked right there. The kid had said he'd left the jacket in the van. With Jorge gone, Mateo became the starting striker the rest of the season. When Mateo said he needed a job, Nicholas vouched for him with his boss at San Jose Airport. The job was baggage handler, not exactly college degree stuff. He figured it'd be fine. Nicholas warned Mateo not to pull anything, though. He didn't want to lose his job. He knew Mateo hadn't really changed after all these years. He still liked to mess with people, not necessarily for his own good. He didn't steal, no matter how poor an upbringing he had, and he was dirt poor. He just couldn't help himself from screwing around. When the first cart of bags from the plane that just landed made its way over to them, they started unloading the bags onto the conveyor belt. Mateo noticed the matching black bags with red tags. He looked at the tags, his eyebrows rising, and then over at Nicholas, who was busy hoisting bags. Julian and Justin made their way through the customs line, which luckily only took about 10 minutes. Their plane wasn't that big, and by the look of the customs line, there was only maybe one other flight that had also just landed. Then they headed to the baggage claim, excited to begin their adventure. They didn't travel much. Marta was antsy. She couldn't help it. She felt like a fugitive on the run, which, frankly, wasn't far from the truth. But not from the cops. Maybe from something worse. She did know two things, though. That the family wouldn't be home until tomorrow, and that even if the husband opened the safe as soon as they got home, she would, if it were hers. They'd have no reason to suspect her until the next cleaning day when she didn't show up. That was still 8 days away, but she was still antsy. She and Thiago got through customs in just a few minutes. Helps to be a local. Then they fast-walked to baggage claim, doing their best not to draw too much attention to themselves, but unable to just walk. They managed to arrive there before the bags started coming. San Jose time, she almost forgot. No hurries here. By the time the bags started flowing, the conveyor belt was surrounded. She heard the guy next to her say to his partner,
See, look how many black bags, told you.
Yeah, but lots of other colors too, the woman replied. We'll be fine, I hope.
Thiago leaned in and whispered in Martha's left ear.
We'll be fine too.
He could see the worry on her face. From the mouth of the baggage monster came a brand new black Tumi bag, replete with snazzy red tag. Justin uttered a, there you go, a little sarcastically. Thiago looked over at him, not sure what he was referencing to. Being positioned just a couple of steps to the right of where the mouth dropped the bags onto the conveyor belt, Thiago reached down to grab the bag. Just then, the next bag appeared over the hump, another brand new black Tumi bag with a red tag. Justin exclaimed, what? Thiago looked at him again, then to the left to see the other bag hit the belt. He looked down at the first bag with the tag, letting the second go by. Justin grabbed it and immediately also looked at the tag.
Thiago said, this ain't ours.
Lifting his head up from the bag to look at Justin, Justin read the tag.
Marta? He said, looking at Thiago.
Yeah, you Jillian?
Yeah, thanks.
They traded bag, all smiles. Justin turned to Julian.
Wow, I thought the red tag would make it unique. What are the odds of that happening?
Jillian looked a little bewildered.
Seriously? Maybe next time we get a weird colored tag, or tie some ribbons or something.
Marta was breathing a big sigh of relief. She felt like someone was conspiring to keep her from getting that money. She just wanted to get out of the airport. Then she'd be in the clear, all set.
Hopefully.
But you never know.
Alright, friends, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour this time here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thanks for tuning in and join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.